Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Let me take you on a journey to the coldest place on Earth and its last and greatest wilderness, on a voyage to Antarctica. Hello and welcome to A Voyage to Antarctica, brought to you by the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust. I'm your host, Alok Jha. This week I'm talking to the award-winning writer Philip Hoare about his lifelong love for and obsession with whales and their history in Antarctica. Philip's numerous books include Leviathan, or The Whale, which won the 2009 BBC Samuel Johnson Prize and has been published all over the world. His latest book, Albert and the Whale, is published by Fourth Estate in the UK. He's also a professor of creative writing at the University of Southampton. One of the things that, if anyone knows anything about your books, is that you are obsessed and love whales. Where did that obsession start?
Well, in a weird sort of way, it did start in childhood with many people, rather like sort of liking dinosaurs. Although for me, it was a very disturbing experience ultimately, because I really was tuned into whales, I suppose, by the whole Save the Whale movement of the late 1960s, early 1970s. And I suppose that's what sensitized me to the whale, apart from seeing them on Jacques Cousteau's documentaries. We pestered, myself and my sisters, who were equally mad on whales and dolphins, pestered our parents to take us to Windsor Safari Park, which had a dolphinarium. It's now Legoland. And we were very, very excited about this. This is back in the early 70s, I guess. And we sat at the front of the pool, which is really an overgrown concrete pool. You know, it's really grim. I actually found some photographs my father took that day, which we never knew he took. But then into this really just brutal place, a pod of dolphins appeared. And then the pool was cleared and a big black gate opened up at the other end, and in swam Ramu, who was billed in the program as our other performer. It was an orca, a killer whale. And for most of your listeners, very aware of orcas, incredibly social, intellectual, or intelligent, maybe intellectual is pushing it, but certainly intelligent, incredibly successful animals, probably the most successful mammal on the planet, not human beings. Orca have been around and they evolved state for 6 million years and they are present in every ocean. And this poor benighted creature jumped through a hoop, balanced a ball on his nose and got a fish as a reward. And for me, that was a kind of a moment of apostasy. I had to stop loving these animals because I saw the way they were treated. So the sort of fast forward from that to the year 2000, when I went on holiday, I went to Cape Cod, And I didn't realize that this is a great whale watching place. And it was only on the day before I was going home, actually, that I realized that you could go out on a boat and see whales. And I was very dubious about this because I thought this would be another kind of circus performance, a mediated human experience. I kind of expected them to be feeding them with fish as well. And I stood on the prow of this whale watch boat along with all the other hunters. And then half an hour later, in the middle of Stellwagen Bank, which is a protected marine reserve off the coast of New England, 40-foot, 40-ton humpback whale jumped down right in front of me. And that's what started me writing about whales. And I have no scientific background. I have no knowledge in that respect. And I didn't really know that much then. But I just went on this crazy voyage of, like, talking to scientists, going on the whale watch boats, going out to the Azores eventually, and getting to know the animals in the water.
So how did you, at that point, you know, in 2000, when you saw this whale leaping from the water and had this visceral experience that was an emotional experience in some respects, how did you then begin to square what you saw there and the subsequent interest in whales with what you'd seen as a child, this trapped whale? What were you trying to sort of get at?
Well, the great way into the whale was through Herman Melville's Moby Dick, because that text, written back in 1851 by a great New Englander who was on the whaling boats as opposed to whale watching boats, and they're quite interestingly comparative, those two processes. They're both humans going out trying to find whales. Melville, no one has ever written better about the whale since Melville, really. And in that great compendious, sprawling, digressive, mad, subversive, sexy, crazy book, I kind of found more questions than answers, but they were kind of questions which were metaphysical and cultural and transcendental and very, very disturbing, because he was trying to work out what he was doing out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, slaughtering these animals. He was part of a whaling mission out to the line, as they called the equator. And Melville, like the other whalers at the time, knew far more than anyone else on this planet, human-wise, that these animals were sentient, that they were socially organized, that they had a kind of culture was expressed in sound, mainly for whales, but also in the demonstration of physical, what we would call affection. There's a description in Moby Dick under in the chapter The Grand Armada, which is, I think, the first piece of natural history documentation from a cultural point of view, certainly in literature. He and Queequeg, who is the Maori-based tattooed warrior in the book, Ishmael, the narrator, both lean over the side of the boat and through this incredibly clear water see a female sperm whale pushing her newly born calf to the surface, still attached by the umbilical cord. And it's a moment of extraordinary connection because they are looking at this thing, this scene for its own sake, for its own beauty. A moment later, they're about to kill them. And then the slaughter in that chapter is terrible to behold. But it's that one point in which Melville allows the kind of emotion that I saw when I was at Windsor Safari Park. And that was what I felt, you know, that kind of cooperation between something that you are creating, that you are, you know, the reason why they could see that is this enormous effort. These humans have gone out in this boat all the way to the ocean to kill these animals. But there's this moment, this kind of interlude at which things could have gone the other way. So for me, the whale represents so many things. It represents this bridge to a natural world, partly because they are so attractive as creatures. They are so mysterious and majestic. You know, the great sort of sometimes dismissive phrase used by biologists is charismatic megafauna. you know, like polar bears and pandas. You know, they're kind of the eye candy of ecology.
The things to get people interested in caring about the world.
Exactly, as opposed to snot-eating worms and et cetera, et cetera. So that's what fascinates me is the whale's experience of human beings. You know, I can write about our experience of whales, but I want to also write about the whale's experience of us.
People probably think of whales as you say, charismatic megafauna, the idea of this beautiful creature in the ocean, and perhaps we should go and watch them, but they should be saved and looked after. Back then, in Herman Melville's time, in Moby Dick's time, this was not the case at all. Could you just describe for us what the human relationship with whales was back in the 19th century? Why were people searching for and killing whales?
Well, they're part of the relentless economic progress of the 19th century. They were part of the Industrial Revolution. They lubricated and lit the Industrial Revolution.
Literally,
whale oil was used in factories, in manufacture. It was used to lubricate pencil lead. It was used to light the streets of London, Paris, New York, and Berlin. It was an essential part of the 19th century imperial and colonizing progress. You know, the whaling ships since the late 18th century had been taking Western influence out to the Pacific, for instance, carrying missionaries, sometimes supplying the missionaries. So that whole sense of the way the world was being opened up to Western influence was predicated on whales and whaling. You know, the colonies of New South Wales and Tasmania, Van Diemen's Land as it was then called, and New Zealand were really dependent on whaling for their development as viable settlements. And so the whale, as unknown as it was, as unseen as it was, very, very, very few people would have ever seen a whale, and certainly not alive. Mostly your experience of a whale was a slumped, deflated monster, a leviathan on a beach. Yet these animals are really an important part of the economic structure of the Western world.
And just to get into the detail, it was a particular part of the blubber of a sperm whale, wasn't it, that was very, very highly prized as an oil for a lot of these purposes?
Well, they were called sperm whales because they believed that the oil, as you mentioned, which is actually present in what is in fact the nose of the animal, so the head, the great square, pugnacious square head of a sperm whale, is filled with spermaceti oil, and it gets its name because the sailors, when it first pierced that head, thought it was the whale's semen. And this oil is, in fact, it's an extraordinary material. It's incredibly fine oil, which becomes waxy when it hits sort of cool air. And if the whale, that oil has a unique quality in that it's a bioacoustical medium through which it can focus its sound and intensify its sound. So it's creating this sound which is bounced back to the back of the skull, the concave skull of the whale, and then focused back through this bioacoustical oil in a series of chambers, and then is emitted. And that sound is the loudest sound naturally created by an animal on the planet. It can get to the loudness of an aeroplane. For humans, that oil was prized because it burnt without smoke. The unit of light itself, the lumen, is the measurement of how much light is given off by certain part a certain measurement of a sperm whale candle. And in places like Nantucket, off the coast of New England, there were huge factories just processing these candles, which were the most desirable form of lighting. Whale oil also burnt smokeless in lamps as well. But the oil was used for many other things, making leather supple. It was used later on during war. It was used as a way to treat trench foot. Wilfred Owen, when he's about to send his troops over the top in the First World War battle, supervises the anointing of their feet in an almost kind of ritualistic way with this whale oil. It's very strange, the paradox again of the whale, that the whale, and the sperm whale, is one of the deepest diving of all whales. It can dive for a mile in depth. It can stay down for 2 hours or more. Yet brings back, as it were, this light-giving energy, as though it's kind of processing the great series of chemical events which life consists of, and that ends up being a candle being burnt in an aristocrat's house.
Listening to you talking just then, I've got some very, very pleasant flashbacks of reading Leviathan, your book, and I would recommend anyone who wants to know about all of this stuff to just go and devour that book. We're talking about how whales have become this magical oil almost that everyone's searching for, that's created almost sort of the aristocratic 19th century lifestyle. And it's also in this hunt for the oil is the reason that the UK, that Britain ends up sort of citing Antarctica, because it's just chasing these animals all around the world. Can you give us a picture of that time? So we know about we talked on this podcast, and people are probably familiar with the heroic age of Antarctic exploration, the Scots and the Shackletons going to the continent and trying to find the South Pole and all of those feats of endurance. But the first sightings of those southern places were from whalers.
With the invention of steam-powered ships, and also much more horrifically of grenade harpoons, these animals came within human remit. They hadn't been for Moby Dick, for Herman Melville. Fin whales and blue whales are too sleek and fast, didn't have a social habit in the way sperm whales and humpback whales have. And suddenly it was kind of open season on these animals. And the slaughter that went on in the Antarctic from the whaling stations established by the British and the Norwegians is incomparable, and much more so because they're so far away from civilization. They're so far out of sight of London and New York and the civilized, quote civilized, centers of commerce and trade, to which these animals are being returned in barrels of oil. They're rendered down, the fat is rendered down, and they end up in the food chain too. In the Second World War, famously, Britain was partly sustained, not in a major way, but certainly whale meat was being eaten. My mother and father recall eating whale meat during the Second World War. There were recipes for whale curry and whale burgers, amazingly enough. And indeed, Southampton, where I'm speaking to you from now, ships were still coming from the Antarctic in the 1960s, laden with whale oil, which became stalk margarine. So anyone who ate stalk margarine in the 1960s was eating whale. You couldn't really avoid whale, actually, up until the 1960s, and probably even the early 70s. It was still part of the economy of the West.
What did all of that do to the whale populations in these previously untouched parts of the world?
Incredibly good question. It killed 3 million great whales and in the 20th century, and that toll is pretty much all down to mostly down to the whaling in the Southern Ocean off Antarctica. And of course, they were killing the largest animals, the largest blue whales. And we know that they were experiencing, certainly at the beginning of the 20th century, blue whales which were larger than they reach now. Because the genetic predominance of the large males was being sort of bred out, really, by the cull that was going on. But what we don't know, and possibly never will know, is what the effect on whale culture was of that Holocaust. While their glycerin was being used to make nitroglycerin for the First and Second World War, where they were literally enabling the destruction of human on human in the First and Second World Wars, their own culture was suffering in a terrible way. I mean, we know now blue whales reduced to, well, certainly at the beginning of the century, down to 15, maybe 18,000. It's a pathetic, paltry number. Estimates of them reaching their millions before the great cull began in the 20th century. Some animals have recovered, and there is some evidence of blue whales recovering in the Antarctic, but they will never possibly return to those numbers.
Hello, I'm Camilla Nichols, CEO of the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust, and I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. We work to preserve and protect Antarctica's unique heritage, from the historic huts of early pioneers to the amazing discoveries in climate science. And our mission is to inspire current and future generations to discover, value and protect this precious wilderness. The pandemic has had a significant impact on our work, and we need your generosity now more than ever. Find out how you can help save Antarctica, protect our planet, and even adopt a penguin at ukaht.org. or search for the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Whaling as a commercial enterprise certainly has largely stopped, and I think that people have understood that killing these animals is going to just decimate their destroy their populations. And in the 80s, we began a moratorium on commercial whaling. Yet some countries still kill whales for commercial and, quote, scientific purposes. What is the justification, if any, for the scientific killing of whales right now?
Well, countries such as Norway, Japan, Iceland, North America, the USA, they hunt whales from a cultural basis, as an indigenous economy. The problem with that is, of course, they're not using traditional methods to kill whales. They're using grenade harpoons and remote killing operations, which are intensely cruel. I mean, these animals can take 3.5 hours to die. And these are animals which, I don't believe in hierarchies of organisms, but they're certainly very, very intelligent, sensate creatures. If you see a whale, and I've often seen humpback whales, for instance, where when they're feeding, seagulls will sort of land on their backs. The whale will quiver with the feeling of a bird on its back. But the whale is an incredibly, it's like us, you know, it's a very sensate creature. And the idea of killing these animals, and countries such as Norway and Japan reason that there are species of whale such as the minke whale that are a resource to be fished. It's a different cultural attitude. And if you go to Iceland or Norway, there will be whale on the menu.
How do you feel about it's that? Not, I mean,
if you're talking about an indigenous tradition, it's difficult to argue about it. But if you're talking about, as in Iceland, for instance, where whale meat consumption is very much a touristy thing, you know, tourists think this is what you do when you go to Iceland, that's much more ambiguous. So even putting aside the fact that you would never be allowed to slaughter a domestic animal for consumption in the way we kill whales. I mean, if it took cows 3.5 hours to die, no one would accept that, I hope. And yet these very rare wild creatures are killed in that way.
Around the world, though, apart from these examples you've talked about, where there's an indigenous tradition in the use of whales like this, around the world, now, what's your sort of impression of how well we're protecting or trying to protect whale populations?
Whales are dying in bycatch, you know, because they are being caught in nets, which ultimately kills them very slowly, either through necrosis, the nets get caught around the peduncle, the part of the tail which meets the body where it's narrow, and that can just rot off. It can lash around, you know, fishing nets can lash around the head of a whale. I've seen that myself a number of times, stops them feeding properly. But then there are other, of course, anthropogenic causes of whale death, which are more insidious, which such as chemicals in the ocean, which pass through the food chain through whales and impact their immune systems. Sound is probably one of the biggest issues for whales. If you imagine when Herman Melville was sailing the seven seas, humans made almost no noise in the ocean. Now it's a cacophony of engines and wind farms and seismic surveys, military sonar. For whales especially, but for most marine organisms actually, who live in a world of sound, because sight isn't usually very useful in the ocean, these have terribly deleterious effects on them. They really affect their communication systems, the way they hunt for food, with the way they find food. And really, we know also they do induce a great deal of stress, so that we know, for instance, that there's a resident population of orca in the northern waters around the UK which have not had a viable calf for the past 10, 15 years.
Can I ask you about the sort of position and importance of animals like whales in an ecosystem? Of course, they're top predators, so that if you take them out, that affects the food chain and then the populations of animals in the sea. But also, we're learning at the end of their lives, whales' bodies themselves can be quite useful stores of carbon. So they can be unlikely climate heroes in a way over their long lives. So what's the sort of importance of these creatures in their ecosystems?
Such a good question. If you consider the removal from the ocean of the biomass of 3 million large animals from in the 20th century, for instance, no matter, it's not taking into consideration hunting now, but the cycle of those whales, so their feces fertilizing the ocean, which of course sequestrates carbon dioxide, because the feces fertilize phytoplankton, and then that fertilizes zooplankton or feeds zooplankton. There's a whole great chunk being taken out of that cycle of sequestering carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and then the thing that I love this notion that you're alluding to, Luke, is whale fall. It's known as whale fall. It's rather poetic and Shakespearean. It's the dark, dead whale that slowly sinks to the bottom of the ocean, and there becomes a whole new ecosystem in itself. There are entire species like the Osedex worm, which are entirely predicated. Their life cycle is entirely dependent on a rotting whale. If you think of the amount of nutrition that's released by that through its flesh and its bone, you have these bone-eating worms. It's a wonderfully. It reminds me of the section, The Tempest, where Ariel talks about a drowned sailor lying there, and his bones make coral, and his pearls make eyes. And there's something very beautiful about that process, because it's the process of life as much as it is the process of death.
Can I just wind up by asking you why Antarctica matters to you?
Rather like the whale, there's something unreachable and huge and numinous and mysterious, but real, and that one day you might get to go there, and one day you might have that experience. There's something very beautifully fragile and hugely weighty about it at the same time. It's almost as though the Earth is weighted by these two areas, and especially with the Antarctic, because we in the northern hemisphere feel as though we're weighted by ice. It's a kind of center of gravity thing in a way that, that holds us in place. It gives us a sense of security in a strange sort of way. So for me, it's an impossibility. It's an impossibility that the world should still be partly frozen, as though it still could develop in another way or go another way. It's like history frozen.
Philip, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Oh, great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. A Voyage to Antarctica is brought to you by the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust. Next time, I'll be talking to Prem Gill to find out what Antarctic seals and grime music have in common. To find out more about our guests, including photos and videos, head to our website at www.ukaht.org or follow our Facebook, Twitter and Instagram pages. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to follow us and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is part of the Trust's Antarctica Insight programme, supported by the Arts Council England, the Garfield Western Foundation, and the Foreign and Commonwealth Development Office. A Voyage to Antarctica was presented by me, Alok Jha, and produced by Jessica Norman. Ben Hewis is digital producer, and the music and sound design is by Alec Hughes.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.